Hello, you're listening to Money on the Left, the official podcast of the Modern Money Network Humanities Division. I'm Billy Soss.
I'm Scott Ferguson.
And we are co-directors of the Modern Money Network Humanities Division, or MMNHD.
MMNHD is a big tent organization for scholars, social critics, and political activists dedicated to recovering and redeeming the cultural and political aspects of modern money, past and present. We do this primarily from a humanities perspective. But we welcome participation from anyone interested in engaging with the school of political economy, known variously as neo-chartalism or modern money theory, MMT for short.
So from our perspective, what's so transformative about MMT is that it turns conventional political economy on its head. Rather than figure money as a politically neutral commodity invented a long time ago by some particularly clever traders in some remote marketplace, MMT shows that money is always and everywhere a boundless public utility, as well as a deliberate political, cultural, and ecological project.
In doing so, MMT makes so much more thinkable and possible than liberal modernity's austerity-driven imagination has historically permitted. It not only expands how money can contribute to collective flourishing, it also reorients how we conceive of cause and effect, as well as how we research and write history. In this podcast, we want to develop and complicate the neo-chartalist imagination on and for the left.
A key way that neo-chartalism reframes money's history concerns the question and politics of employment. While the hegemonic liberal paradigm treats employment as a function of private hiring and firing, neo-chartalism understands employment as a thoroughly political decision. The liberal variation permits modest government assistance and makes unemployment inevitable. But MMT insists that employment is first and foremost a policy choice, and that full, inclusive, and ecologically responsible employment is always affordable.
In terms of format, the Money on the Left podcast plans to feature conversations, scholarly and political, close readings of texts, interviews, and occasionally some fresh hot takes on current events. In this, our first episode, we invited historian David Stein to help us make sense of the recent resurgence of full employment legislation and debate in the United States. David is currently a fellow at UCLA's Luskin Center for History and Policy and a lecturer in the departments of History and African American Studies. His first book will be published in 2019 by University of North Carolina Press. Its title, Fearing Inflation, Inflating Fears, The Civil Rights Struggle for Full Employment and the Rise of the Carceral State, 1929 to 1986. With Betsy Beasley, he co-hosts Who Makes Sense, a History of Capitalism podcast, which we chat with him about at the end of the interview.
We asked David for some historical perspective on the proposals for a jobs guarantee put forward recently by Senators Bernie Sanders, Kirsten Gillibrand, and Cory Booker, who each seem ready to make the JG a critical plank of their 2020 presidential campaigns. Now, lots of us in the MMT world are thrilled to see the JG taken up by the frontrunners for the Democratic nomination, but some others on the left, many of whom have never challenged the liberal money story, worry that the jobs guarantee is alternately pie-in-the-sky progressivism or just another route to workfare. As you'll hear, David puts both the historical fight for full employment and these left critiques in a broader historical context. We were joined in our conversation with David by Max Seho, a graduate student in film and media studies at the University of South Florida. Without further ado, here's our conversation with David. You've done fantastic work documenting the history of full employment movements in the United States. How exciting have these last couple of weeks been for you? What has excited you most?
Well, thank you for having me. It's been thrilling to see the reemergence of full employment and guaranteed jobs to its place of prominence within the dominant agenda of the Democratic Party. It is a demand that has a long history within the Democratic Party, from the 1940s through the 1980s, but really fell out of the Democratic Party's platform in the 1980s and grew weaker in the platform in 1984 and 1988. And, you know, I know a number of activists who really fought to get it back into the party's platform in 2016. So that in and of itself was was really exciting. And I think to see Senators Gillibrand and to see Senator Sanders and Senator...
Senator Booker.
And Senator Booker all come out, thank you, all come out in support of various versions of guaranteed jobs, I think has really pushed it to the front of our political agenda. And I think it really can reopen our imaginations about what's possible. And so I think that's really exciting. And the idea that this is going to be a durable kind of conversation over the next few years, to me, is completely a reorientation of where we were just a few years ago. I started writing this project, this book that I'm in the process of finishing, back in the years after the 2008 recession. And I was part of it. I was puzzled as to, you know, why guaranteed jobs weren't emerging as a key solution to the unemployment crisis that so many people were facing. So to see it now, a decade later, after years of inadequate recovery in terms of, you know, how the recovery's been experienced in everyday people's lives, to me is a real exciting moment, and I think testament to a lot of activism that a lot of people have been doing for over this past decade.
Yeah, it's interesting that this conversation is starting back up 10 years after, you know, the worst of the financial crisis. What do you think it is, like, what had to go away or what had to happen in order for this conversation to be happening now, do you think?
I mean, I think a few things. I think, you know, usually after, you know, I think there's a, you know, combination of a number of factors. One, I think the completely inadequate recovery of government jobs at the state municipal level, which we've now seen over recent weeks, also with all the teacher strikes happening. I think that's part of that inadequate recovery over the past decade. I haven't seen the recent stats, but I know as of a little while ago, you know, I think it was something like a million jobs were lost in state and municipalities that have just never kind of have never returned. I think, you know, those of us who are in academia really have seen this very clearly. So I think that's one element. I think another element is the 2016 election. You know, just like in after the 1972 election, and the Democratic Party sort of believed that they had moved too far left in that election and began reorienting towards the right, and especially after the 1980 election. I think the 2016 election, alongside the immense energy that was posed, that met the Sanders campaign, I think that's propelled some of these conversations. I also think just the tremendous amount of grassroots activism has really propelled this conversation. And then I think at the Federal Reserve level, or at the level of kind of policy wonk, conversations around inflation, the inadequate return or the inadequate wage gains that have been made by workers, even amidst relatively low unemployment rates over the past few years, has really posed questions about the extent to which the Phillips curve and ideas like that continue to hold purchase. I believe it was Daniel Tarullo, who, former key powerful actor within the Federal Reserve System, now retired, who gave a talk at Brookings a few months ago saying, you know, the Federal Reserve has no coherent theory of inflation. And whereas inflationary fears really stifled the efforts to legislatively win guaranteed jobs over decades. And so I think all of those factors have contributed.
So on this podcast, we're really interested in the humanities and what the humanities can bring to the study of political economy, and then specifically through a neo-chartalist lens. And you know, much of this story and the way it's playing out now, and the big actors are politicians, economists, as you said, policy wonks, certainly, you know, organizers and activists of various stripes. But clearly there's a place and a role for us humanists, right? You in particular, you're not just studying what's going on. You're participating in your own way, whether it's with Fed Up or just on Twitter. And I'm curious if you can speak to your own role in how this is playing out and how the study of history and maybe the humanities approach more generally is kind of important for this fight.
Yeah, well, I think I have a few different answers to that question. One of them is, you know, I'm glad you asked this early on, because I think, you know, if anyone tunes out later, I think there's one. I think I have two key lessons that I would say are really important going forward. The first one is that if we think about how this was a key goal of the civil rights movement, one of the most powerful social movements I know of ever to exist, that broke the U.S. apartheid system, that movement was not strong enough to fully achieve a governmental jobs guarantee. I think if history provides a guide for us, it's that our movements may or will need to be stronger than that, which I think is a really, really daunting task and a humbling task. But I also think from having studied social movements that an appropriate power analysis is a key starting point for any struggle. So I think that's one lesson. And I think the other key lesson is that in the post-1948 era or so, I can think of about a 4-year span when winning these sorts of proposals could have been possible had the movement been strong enough. And that's the years 1964 to 1966 and 1976 to 1978. And I think, you know, you could make an argument that, you know, had the movements appeared in 2008 to 2010, that they might have been legislatively possible. The movements were not anywhere there during 2008 to 2010. And so I think what that lesson shows us is that these openings can appear quickly and they can disappear just as quickly, and we don't know when they're going to return again. And so I think it's really vital, and back to the first question, one of the things I've been most excited about right now is that I think, you know, and I hope we're preparing for what might that opening that might occur in 2020, between 2020 and 2022. And I think that we need to be ready when that opening appears, because we don't know when it's going to appear again. And I think those to me are the two key lessons that history teaches us. And then the third, and sort of subsidiary to those two, and this more goes against some of the articles and essays that I've been reading that are a bit ignorant of the history of this demand, that portray it as a demand so far out of a field or so incompatible with U.S. history and U.S. policy history, is to assert that, you know, in the key reason that we don't have this already, or at least it wasn't achieved in 1945, we don't know what would have happened after that, we can't jump too far back into the counterfactuals, but the key reason, you know, this wasn't achieved in 1945 was because of Jim Crow, and because of the role of Jim Crow power in Congress. And to a certain extent, it's a similar story in the 1960s. In part of the reason that, one key reason why job, why, you know, demands for full employment and job guarantees weren't included in the war on poverty was because Johnson knew they could never get through Wilbur Mills's House Ways and Means Committee. Wilbur Mills was considered at the time to be one of the most powerful members of Congress, if not the most powerful member of Congress. Well, where did Wilbur Mills come from? He was, you know, the longtime congressman from Arkansas, from a Jim Crow district. And so, you know, his power was, you know, very much linked with the kind of daily life of a Jim Crow society. And of course, you know, when we look at, you know, all these key Dixiecrat congressmen, most of them don't leave Congress by way of democracy. They leave Congress, you know, in Mills's case via scandal and disgrace. In many other people's case, via death. You know, they don't leave Congress, a lot of them, until the 2000s, some in the 90s, some in the 80s. But it's not just, it's not like the Voting Rights Act passes and these congressmen, and I say men specifically, and these congressmen just pack up their briefcases and go home in 1965. They continue to win election after election. And so I think, you know, knowing that history can also show that although job guarantees were never able to, you know, win them, movements were never able to achieve those goals legislatively, it wasn't because they weren't a dominant moral value. I think guaranteed jobs, full employment was a dominant moral value from the 1940s through the 1970s, but they were never able to you know, kind of push those Dixiecrat congressmen out of their positions of power in order to win legislatively.
So a follow up to that, let's say skeptics will often point to Michael Kolesky's now famous article, "The Political Aspects," or what is it called, "The Political Obstacles" or "Political Aspects of Full Employment."
Aspects
of full employment, and they sort of presume that his argument is that, sure, this is monetarily, economically possible, but it may not be and probably isn't politically possible. And my response to this is always, well, let's be historical about this, right? I mean, Kolesky was engaging with this question. He was wrestling with this question at a very particular juncture when we were in a post-war context, full employment. The question of full employment was haunting everybody. Very different groups were weighing in, had different visions for what this might look like, how possible it was going to be or not be. And I guess my question to you, David, is if the political aspects and or obstacles to full employment are historical, what do you see today? What are the historical conditions which may prove may facilitate this movement and may block it?
It's a really good question. Well, I think one, to me, one of the biggest lessons of history is that one is forced to confront with immense humility what is possible in a given moment and how few people have any sense of what that is, both, you know, optimistically and pessimistically. You know, I one of the lessons that I really try and teach my students is a lesson that the scholar George Lipsitz writes about and that his writing has taught to me. And he says, you know, very few people in 1859, very few abolitionists could have known that, you know, their decades of effort, the self-activity of enslaved people, the kind of, you know, resistance of running away, of breaking one's hose, you know, all sorts of things like that, that those would see their expression in the self-activity of enslaved people amidst the Civil War, and that enslavement would be abolished, never to return in the United States. Very few people could have envisioned that in 1859. And so to me, one of the things I've been inspired by in my writing about full employment movements is that I tried to write as if these movements could and would reemerge. And the second they did, and the second they achieved their goals, suddenly the entire history of struggling for these goals would look different. You know, that right this second, you can look at the history of struggles for full employment and say, it's been 80 years of failure. And then the second that changes, that history appears differently. The second guaranteed jobs appear, it's like, wow, it took 80 years of robust activism to achieve this goal. And I've tried to write with that day in mind. And I've thought about it alongside other activists. So, you know, in the weeks after the March on Washington, Bayard Rustin, the lead organizer of the March on Washington, is giving a speech, and he says, you know, things like, "We're losing the fight, my friends." He says, "We're losing quickly. Where are we winning?" And he's very frustrated in that moment, and he doesn't, you know, after three decades of activism, he doesn't know what historians know, which is that the Civil Rights Act of 1964 is right on the horizon. Then the Voting Rights Act is right on the horizon. And so in the weeks after the March on Washington, he doesn't feel this, you know, tremendous swelling of success because he doesn't know what's on the horizon. And so I think, you know, we don't know what's possible. And so for those who are writing, like, you know, full employment is so difficult because of, you know, XYZ problem or XYZ thing. You know, I tell one person writing, you know, what about the Fed? And it's like, okay, yeah, that's a key issue that, you know, Coretta Scott King really, really cared about. And I think, and to me, it's really important to ask that question, but not in a way that's about saying it's impossible and throwing up its hands, but to say, like, yeah, like, the Fed, which is a institution that that is created by Congress, relative autonomy, its independence is institutionalized in congressional in legislation, and so that would need to be addressed in any legislation. You know, how the Fed would need to adhere itself to an employment mandate, to a, you know, federal employment mandate for all, at least so far as, you know, the U.S. continues to have a capitalist democracy. And so I think, like, those are elements to struggle over and to work out and to be aware of in the writing of the policy, but they're not reasons to not struggle for it and promote it.
You brought up Coretta Scott King already, and, you know, I was wondering if you could talk about the relationship between her lifelong activism and this current movement, and maybe dig in a little bit into detail as to the things you were linking to your last comment about the Fed and things like that.
Yeah, so you mentioned it in an earlier question about the Fed Up campaign. So I co-wrote a few months ago, I co-wrote a report with The Economist, Dean Baker, on behalf of and in collaboration with the Center for Popular Democracy's Fed Up campaign, which has worked really hard to get the Federal Reserve to be more accountable to everyday people whose lives are impacted every day by the interest rates they pay on their credit card bills or student loans. Or car payments, as well as the general level of the economy. So, you know, Coretta Scott King was the founder. She co-founded and led this group called the Full Employment Action Council and the National Committee for Full Employment. They were kind of parallel organizations that were slightly separated for tax purposes. She co-led that organization, that coalition, starting in 1974. And the goal was to achieve guaranteed jobs legislation. And she was well aware, as anyone was in the 1970s, of the high interest rate policies of the Fed and how the Fed needed to adhere to its employment mandate. There's debates about from scholars about where the employment mandate comes from. I found recent evidence that it does indeed go back to the 1946 Employment Act. But the Fed, you know, didn't abide that employment mandate as strongly as they might have, to say the least. And so it was for that reason that many scholars trace the employment mandate to the 1977 Federal Reserve Reform Act and the 1978 Humphrey Hawkins Act, of which Coretta Scott King was the key activist, and her organization were the key activists promoting the 1978 Humphrey Hawkins Act, which had been around and been drafted throughout the mid-1970s. And they knew that in order to achieve guaranteed jobs and full employment, they needed the Fed to accede to those goals. And so Dean Baker and I wrote this report, in a sense, in trying to remember this history of the Fed's employment mandate and promote the goal of the Fed keeping interest rates low, continuing to facilitate economic recovery, and continuing to adhere to the law. And so, you know, most people know, if people know of the 1978 Full Employment Humphrey Hawkins Act at all, it's because, you know, when the Fed comes to Congress twice a year, it's called the Humphrey Hawkins testimony. And this was one of the acts that Coretta Scott King and legislators Augustus Hawkins and Hubert Humphrey tried to create in order to ensure that the Fed would be accountable to those who were democratically elected to Congress. And prior to that, you know, the reason that's really important is because prior to that, you know, in the 1970s, you had leading economists with the Joint Economic Committee saying they couldn't even get basic data from the Fed at the time. The Fed was, you know, acting as if it was, you know, completely autonomous, that their independence was, you know, completely autonomous from Congress. And so this legislation was the attempt to get the Fed to be more accountable to Congress, and thus more accountable to the people of the United States who were impacted by their policies. And, you know, in order to fight for that legislation, there's all sorts of exciting stories I can tell you about. You know, I think the 1977 Full Employment Action Week is really inspiring, where, you know, 1.5 million people took all sorts of actions in order to protest and propel the legislation. You know, there were parades in Erie, Pennsylvania, with 40,000 people attending, things of that sort that I think are, you know, really on a scale of activism that is quite significant. Augustus Hawkins said it was, you know, the most amazing activism he'd seen since the March on Washington of 1963. So that can give our audience a sense of just how powerful this effort was.
Coretta Scott King, you know, argues that we've never really dealt honestly with the question of a peacetime economy. And this is something that I've spent a little bit of time thinking about in relationship to the kind of full employment debates of today. And I was wondering how, you know, what you thought about the relationship between World War II and the mobilization and the job guarantee debates and her activism, and kind of how those all go together in this history, especially, as you say, if we're to really succeed now and really actualize this history for our present moment. We need to understand the way these certain strains of contestation kind of interact with full employment and the war itself. So I was wondering if you had any thoughts about that.
Yeah. So I think this is also really important for thinking about some of the contemporary critiques of full employment and guaranteed jobs, the people who say, you know, oh, it's too hard. It's administratively, how would it work? You know, it's just way too complicated. And so when we think back to the generation that Coretta Scott King was a part of, she was born in 1927. She lived through the Great Depression. She saw World War II. And they saw just a complete reorientation of the scale and scope of what the federal government could do. And that enlivened their imaginations about what was possible, and gave them confidence to call for these sorts of bold demands. And so, you know, I was thinking while you're asking your question of a quote from William Lucy, who was a leader and co-founder of the Coalition of Black Trade Unionists in the early 1970s. And this is a group, the Coalition of Black Trade Unionists, which, as far as I'm aware, no group has continually promoted full employment guaranteed jobs as long as this group has. So to the extent that, like, you know, people remember, you know, full employment. I saw one article that was a fairly good article, but that was like, you know, why full employment is back from the dead, you know, or something along those headlines. And it was like, well, it never died. And the reason it never died was because of people like Bill Lucy and people in the Coalition of Black Trade Unionists, as well as, you know, as you all are well aware of the kind of post-Keynesian economic tradition. But so Bill Lucy, you know, has this quote in the early 1970s amidst these full employment movements. This is in 1975, and he says, you know, in the wartime, when they gear up the war machine, everybody fits into a slot. They make welders out of laborers and pipe fitters out of farmers. And so for him, he saw that, and he'd seen that experience. And so he then said, you know, so this is why the federal government should now employ people in transportation, construction, and health services, and environmental work, right? So they were thinking, you know, dialectically, if you will, to say, you know, the military-industrial complex and the World War II effort showed them what was politically and economically possible. But as dedicated peace activists like Coretta Scott King was, and like her husband was, and like many others, they saw, you know, well, why don't we reorient this spending and this energy towards social needs that really fulfill human lives. And so I think that's a key element. And they'd also just seen, you know, we need to remember this is amidst the Vietnam War and in the years after the Vietnam War, depending on, you know, Scott King's activism continues after the Vietnam War. But for her, you know, she saw, okay, we have this economy that's so tied into to militarism that has helped propel this war effort. And so as an anti-war activist, she was like, okay, well, we need an economy that's geared towards peace and an economy that's geared towards social needs. As she puts it, she says, quote, "We're going to have to create meaningful jobs, jobs that serve human need. As long as there are people, you are going to have certain health needs, healthcare needs, education needs, things that, you know, will make for a better quality of living." So this is what she believed in. And she also believed that, she says, quote, you know, jobs that go beyond the profit-making motive. So, you know, I've been thinking a lot about what the job guarantee could do to you know, decarbonize our environment, to clean up the environment. Of course, you know, to end the water poisoning of an entire city. Like, we've just accepted that the Flint water crisis is, you know, going to continue indefinitely. And it's just, I'm struggling for words to describe, you know, how we make, how we wake up every day and we just allow that to continue. And I think,
yeah,
go ahead.
There's such a disconnect between this pervasive feeling and discourse around around crisis and around needs, right? We know the many, many things that we need to address. And then when we get to some of the job guarantee rhetoric and the job guarantee debate, especially this last week, and suddenly those needs go away. Suddenly everything is good enough. Suddenly it's, you know, the private sector has, you know, the private sector will take care of it. I wanted to bring up something that, David, you and I have kind of talked about in the past, and I know you're not principally an aesthetic theorist or student of visual culture, principally, but I'm curious to have you speak to kind of the aesthetics and visual culture around various moments of full employment struggles, campaigns, fights. And it seems to me that questions of certainly race, if not also gender and sexuality, and of course class, kind of come into play a part in this, right? And one of the things that I've been extremely frustrated by in contemporary discourse around just employment, right? Especially around like national elections, like pre-job guarantee, the job guarantee kind of debates that have been happening very, very recently, where we can only imagine jobs or, you know, employment politics through the image of a kind of Nixon hard hat, right? Like a white guy who's gonna, you know, do some tough infrastructure jobs. And, you know, sure, we want plenty of those, but there's a whole diverse world out there. And I'm curious if you, just in your research, maybe even anecdotally, could reflect on just the aesthetics of full employment politics in the past.
Yeah. Well, I think there's a few things that I'd say to that. I think one, like you suggested, we need to reorient our conception of work around. You know, there's all these conversations about the future of work, but there's, you know, a group of people at the Bureau of Labor Statistics who, at least among, you know, a lot of the, you know, kind of big, you know, headline conversations about the future of work, the Bureau of Labor Statistics folks don't seem to be really consulted in that. And I just pulled it up on my computer, what the Bureau of Labor Statistics puts out, you know, the fastest growing occupations outlook every few years. And if you look at it, I think it's quite indicative and quite important and can, I think, reorient our ideas around what this looks like. So the number one fastest growing occupation, says BLS, is solar panel installers, then wind turbine service technicians, then home healthcare aides, then personal care aides, then physician's assistants, than nurse practitioners, right? So that's what the future of work, at least, you know, according to BLS, according to them, looks like. You know, and if we think about, you know, especially the care work of home healthcare aides, personal care aides, physician's assistants, nurse practitioners, these are jobs that historically have been done by women of color, by Black women, and to the extent that you know, things like home healthcare aides, to the extent that those jobs are low paid right now, according to BLS, the median pay for home healthcare aides and personal care aides is $27,000 per year. Anyone who knows anything about those jobs knows that those are incredibly difficult jobs, incredibly skilled jobs, and jobs that require tremendous amount of compassion, of energy, of physical hard work, of, you know, lifting, making beds, you know, doing so many different tasks. And so if we ask, you know, why aren't these jobs paid $100,000 a year? Why aren't they compensated commensurate to the skill that one sees in those jobs. And well, a big part of that is goes back to the history of racism and the history of patriarchy in this country. And so when I think about, you know, what the future of work could look like or does look like, I think about home health care aides and how they can be compensated to in ways commensurate with how difficult those jobs are, and also with, you know, how important those jobs are to a dignified life for elderly people and all other people who those home health aides and personal care aides are helping with their daily lives to lead, you know, fulfilling dignified life. And then I think, you know, there's all sorts of other questions. If we think back to aesthetics and the WPA and art, I think, you know, I was just speaking with a friend of mine who's I think is, you know, a really, really brilliant, inspiring artist, Evan Bissell, who's out of the Bay Area, who did and a really extraordinary project a few years ago around the 50th anniversary of the March on Washington, as well as a number of other, you know, real community engaged art projects. Evan also is an urban planner, and so he's done a lot of work around community art to talk about the housing crisis and things of that nature. And I just think about, you know, how many other artists are out there doing work like Evan's that, you know, is not necessarily going to be, you know, compensated by the market. There's not a strong market for, you know, creating beautiful murals that educate a community about their rent control rights, which is the kind of work that Evan does. Or about, you know, he did a project with the Morris Justice Project out of the City University in New York to organize against broken windows policing in New York, and he, you know, painted these beautiful pictures of in collaboration with members of the local community that say, you know, we are not broken windows, that showed, you know, what the community actually looked like, and so, you know, I think, you know, there's not a strong market for that type of work, and I, you know, always ask, you know, what images of beauty and safety can be proliferated with a job guarantee. Of course, you know, as I mentioned a minute ago, if we go back to the WPA, you had people writing plays, the Federal Theater Project. You also had murals. You also had, you know, art workers. You had people writing guidebooks to their cities, people like Zora Neale Hurston and Richard Wright. So I think, you know, there's so much that people could be doing work that the market has not necessarily chosen to compensate.
3, 4. I got something, y'all, in my bones. Make me want to shout hallelujah, and I want to sing along. Lift every voice and sing, till it in heaven rain. Ring with the harmony, oh, let it be. Let our rejoicing rise high. Loud as the Lord see.
What's been, I think, exciting about this week, like watching how people are talking about the job guarantee, is to sort of notice the kind of arguments that have fallen off that were active for like the last 30 years, specifically around the pay for question and the idea of fiscal responsibility and the fiscal constraints. And that's too ambitious. You're going to take our taxpayer money and all those sorts of things. That seems to sort of have taken a backseat, if not disappeared. But we have, at the same time, these other kind of rhetorical currents or obstacles that are rising up as we talk about full employment in a real sense and in a federal jobs guarantee. So the rhetoric of workfare circulating now. And as this is happening and thinking about these new rhetorical obstacles that might take the place or take precedent over the fiscal responsibility talk, I wonder if you might say a little bit about the sort of rhetorical currents and arguments that were used between 64 and 66 and 76 and 78, when you say that these movements were most possible. Like, what were the arguments then? And what were the big rhetorical obstacles put in front of Coretta Scott King and others like Bayard Rustin and Leon Kaiserling and the Freedom Budget? What were people saying then?
Yeah, well, I guess to take those, firstly, I've been, frankly, a bit mystified by the claim that this would be workfare, in the sense that every single person who I know who has fought for guaranteed jobs over the past 80 years, was always about expanding the social welfare state through social movement organizing. And these are also, like most activists, they thought dialectically. So they thought, okay, we win something, and then we continue working on it. It's not like we win a goal and then we go home and retire. It's always about, winning something. Usually, for these activists, they demanded 10 things and they won 3 of them. And then they, took that list of 7 things they didn't win and continued working on it. So for them, the job guarantee was never the end of the road. It was always, okay, well, now how does that reorient the political landscape? And now how do we keep working towards greater degrees of justice and equality for all people? And then the other thing is that for these activists, a job guarantee wasn't the only thing they were fighting for. It was one of many. And for them, a job guarantee wasn't about reducing the social welfare state that currently existed in any way. It was about expanding it, as I said a minute ago. And in the 1960s, there were various ways in which the full employment campaigns did and did not work in kind of synchronicity with the welfare rights movement. Some of which had to do with assumptions about male breadwinner ideas and male work. Some of which had to do with a number of other things that are a bit more idiosyncratic. But then there's also elements to where, this won't surprise anyone who's involved in contemporary activism or who has ever been in contemporary activism, was that at least in Seattle, and I haven't been able to explore this more thoroughly in other locales, but at least in Seattle, the people who are meeting around guaranteed jobs and full employment on, say, Wednesday night, were then meeting and organizing around welfare rights on, say, Thursday night or Friday night, right? But they were like, these organizations are going to be formally separate. They weren't collapsing them. And of course, no political formation fought against the nascent system of workfare more than the National Welfare Rights Organization in the mid to late 1960s. And Coretta Scott King was a strong supporter of the National Rights Organization and their support of a guaranteed annual income for all, which of course is different than a universal basic income. They've been kind of collapsed historically in recent years, but I've seen some collapse them, but that's very different than what Martin Luther King or Coretta Scott King or what the National Welfare Rights Organization was fighting for. They were promoting a guaranteed annual income for everyone who was unable to work for whatever reason due to care work responsibilities, and they were fighting for dignity for all people, whether through a job or through guaranteed annual income. But it wasn't a universal basic income that would apply to everyone. So So back to your question about what was so all that's to say that the claim that adding a federal jobs guarantee to our otherwise existent welfare state that would somehow be workfare has I find it, as I said, a bit mystifying. It doesn't. There's not one significant supporter of guaranteed jobs that I can think of in the past 80 years who would have endorsed that that type of proposal, and I can't imagine, you know, very many people, if any, you know, would endorse that kind of proposal today. You know, this is also, as I mentioned, Wilbur Mills earlier, the congressman from Arkansas. He was one of the chief proponents of the work incentive program and the types of, you know, kind of early workfare that was created in the 1960s that the National Welfare Rights Organization and the Poor People's Campaign and Coretta Scott King were fighting against during that era. So not only is the charge that job guarantee advocates would create workfare inaccurate. In point of fact, job guarantee advocates and guaranteed annual income activists, you know, fought against the nascent system of workfare in the 1960s. And so back to your question about, you know, what some of the arguments against full employment were in the 1960s and in 1970s. In the 1960s, a lot of the arguments were about sort of upsetting the balance of payments problems that were going on during that period. And by the 1970s, you know, the key arguments against it were that it would be inflationary.
Would it be inflationary?
To be honest, I'm probably not the best person to answer okay. that. As a historian, I think you know there's reasons to think it might. I think, you know, as Coretta Scott King said, you know, we people, you know, or to kind of paraphrase her, you know, the unemployed are not pawns to be sacrificed in some economic chess game. So if the cost of you know a bit of inflation is the human cost is, you know, the immense unemployment that is, you know, that hits transgender workers, formerly imprisoned people, Black people, Latino people, the worst. You know, if that's the acceptable cost of stabilizing the economy, then I think, you know, we really need to pose critical questions about that and who those policies serve and who they don't. And I think, you know, as Daniel Tarullo said, as I mentioned, the Fed and most economists don't have a coherent theory of inflation. And so, you know, that's where I'm like, well, I trust Daniel Tarullo. You know, he knows more about it than I do. And so if he says that the Fed doesn't have a coherent theory of inflation, I don't see, you know, I don't see how and why you can continue to go on sacrificing such human capacities and human beings' lives and to this idea that it would be inflationary when you know people like him are not even sure that this idea has any purchase any longer.
Well, and that definition of full employment was one of the things that Coretta Scott King pushed back on, right? And you've written about this, you know, defining it as, you know, 5% unemployment doesn't quite, you know, make sense. So zero involuntary unemployment being the preferred definition of full employment for Coretta Scott King. Have you seen people bringing up that discussion of, you know, the rhetorical aspects of full employment recently around this jobs guarantee, these jobs guarantee proposals?
I've seen a bit of it. I haven't seen a ton. My colleague, the economist Mark Paul, and I have been talking about maybe writing something. Now that I said that out loud to you all, maybe we actually have to write it that traces that. And that was a consistent ideological struggle during this period was the definition of full employment, because, you know, as the idea of the non-accelerating inflation rate of unemployment takes hold, the idea of the NAIRU takes hold, you know, people keep saying, you know, unemployment, full employment equals, like you said, you know, 4%, 5%, 6%, and so forth, which really, you know, contrasted to how what full employment meant, say, in the 1940s, when it became, you know, a popular concept, as William Beveridge, who really helped popularize the concept, says in his book. He says, you know, full employment means jobs at decent wages where people are located, and that there should always be, you know, more vacant jobs than unemployed, he says unemployed men, and I think, you know, we would think of that concept, we would, you know, excise the man in that sentence today, but I think that definition is really important, and to see how, you know, that was what it meant in the 1940s, and what is being struggled over in the 1970s is the definition of it, and the definition we've inherited is one that was, you know, antagonistic to what Beveridge and many others proposed, and we can even see that if you read the congressional debates over the 1945 full employment bill, you can see that definition being struggled over, and you have, you know, leaders of the National Association of Manufacturers, you know, arguing for the sort of definition that many people currently have of it today, that it's, you know, whatever percentage economic policy economic, you know, policymakers deem appropriate in order to stabilize the inflation rate. That's obviously not the tradition. That's not the civil rights tradition of what full employment means.
Yeah, it strikes me as one of those phrases or terms that has gotten the historical privilege of not having to be defined. And when I talk to students about, or I ask them about, you know, what is full employment, the first thing that comes to mind is not 5% unemployment. It is everybody has a job, and it, what's, you know, what might be salutary about this current resurgence of jobs guarantee talk is a repoliticization of that idea of what counts as full employment. Yeah. Sorry, please write that essay.
I wanted to shift gears a little bit to more contemporary and think about, you know, the relationship to the history that you've discussed and the fight for full employment, and also kind of a step beyond that to kind of the contemporary black struggle, specifically in the rise of Black Lives Matter over the last decade, and sort of how your history and what the questions that you're thinking about in your book can inform the movement today, and the kind of fight for racial justice today, and how that kind of can coincide with the job guarantee.
Yeah. Well, I think, you know, I mentioned Coalition of Black Trade Unionists. They've continued to promote a job guarantee for decades, you know, and in other new formations alongside the rise of the Black Lives Matter movement, groups like the Black Youth Project 100 have also called for a job guarantee. So I think the way I see it is that the broad black freedom movements have had the longest tradition fighting for guaranteed jobs for all. And a lot of it comes through the moral values of people over profit, that human beings' lives are more important than the profit motive and more important than profit, which is a durable moral value across black freedom movements. And I think the other way I think about it is, I think there's multiple sort of streams of welfare state traditions. And I've, you know, been thinking about this as I developed my dissertation, in collaboration with one of my advisors and mentors and now friends, the historian Robin D.G. Kelly. One thing that he and I had talked about, and that I really learned from him, is that, you know, while many people trace the welfare state tradition to Germany and Otto von Bismarck, there was also, as I've written, a contemporaneous black radical tradition of welfare state struggle during Reconstruction. W.E.B. Du Bois called this this tradition abolition democracy, which was the focus on creating new democratic institutions in order to provide safety and social provision for all people, while also seeking to eradicate institutions of racial violence and any vestige of enslavement. So there needed to be both a negative abolition of enslavement and a positive abolition, the creation of these new institutions. And I see the kind of moral values of abolition democracy that, you know, in the 1870s might have expressed themselves as calls for things like, you know, land access for the formerly enslaved. In the 1940s, I really think, and after, I think we really see those expressing themselves or articulating themselves as calls for a job guarantee within Black freedom movements. And I think we see that tradition continue through to today. And it's also part of the radical humanism of Black freedom movements that's a, you know, kind of consistent force throughout their history. I've been teaching a course on women in the Black freedom movement over the past few weeks and this quarter. And we just finished reading Ella Baker's biography, of course, by Professor Barbara Ransby. And one thing Professor Ransby notes is that, you know, for Baker, she secularized her childhood social values in the Black Baptist tradition and expressed them throughout her life in the form of radical humanism, calls for job guarantees and economic justice for all. And so I think, you know, we can see the expression of those types of social and moral values throughout the Black freedom movement in different forms from Reconstruction through to today.
Well, I was thinking perhaps to conclude what has been a really rich dialogue, we could get you to talk a little bit about and plug your podcast.
So I host a monthly podcast called Who Makes Sense, a History of Capitalism podcast. Sense is spelled C-E-N-T-S. You can find us on whomakessensepodcast.com. I produce it and co-host it with my colleague Betsy Beasley. And you know, we talk about some of these issues. You know, I do a lot less talking on that show. folks who are listening to this show might be interested in a number of our episodes. You know, we have an episode with Sandy Bryan Hager on public debt and inequality that you know, harmonizes with the modern monetary theory, post-Keynesian tradition. We also have, you know, great episodes with LaShawn Harris on the history of Black women in the informal economy. We have, you know, an episode with Jeff Mann on you know, what he describes as a Keynesian sensibility. We also have an important episode with Kim Phillips Fine on the fiscal crisis in New York in the 1970s and the rise of austerity politics. One more episode folks might be interested in is an episode with the scholar Mirza Barreteron on banking for lower income Americans. And she talks a bit about some of her ideas about postal banking and things like that. And then lastly, I'd just say one more. I know I've given you a lot, but folks might be interested in our episode with Sarah Jaffe on social movements since the 2008 recession. Sarah Jaffe also did a really important, she's a journalist who did a really important interview with the activist Addie Barkin about the jobs guarantee and how it's kind of coming in this moment of resurgence. So Sarah's episode with Addie might be her own show with Addie might be inspiring for folks listening, as well as Sarah's work generally and her book on and our interview with her about social movements since the 2008 recession.
Do you want to say anything about your book project? And yeah, I mean, we've spoken about it generally, and I think maybe very specifically at points, but.
Yeah, I think I'd just say that, you know, I'm finishing a book on civil rights struggles for guaranteed jobs from and how and why those were stifled and how the kind of stifling of those struggles helped facilitate the rise of mass incarceration. And that project goes, or temporal scope is from the 1929, the Great Depression, to 1986, with the passage of the Omnibus Crime Control and Safe, with the Anti-Drug Abuse Act of 1986 and the Tax Reform Act of 1986. And I'm finishing that up as we speak, and it should be out in the next 18 months or so from University of North Carolina Press.
To keep up with David and his many projects, follow him on Twitter at David P. Stein. For more Money on the Left related content, follow us on Twitter at Money on the Left, and subscribe to our YouTube and Vimeo channels, which are each called Modern Money Network, Humanities Division. Special thanks to Alex Williams for producing this podcast and for being one half of Hillbilly Motobike, the excellent Montreal-based drums and electronics duo that hooked us up with our theme song. Feels like something's changed.